This is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
I'm sure I've auditioned for Joe sometime at some point in my career. Maybe
I can't believe that's true. You would have gotten the part.
Thanks.
Right answer.
Yeah. Thanks, buddy. Thank you. I've never met you. You've been living because I think the New York LA thing. In LA, Joe, right?
I'm in. Well, I grew up on the East Coast, but I came out here in '73, and I've been out here.
Yeah. There's that difference in the coastal thing. That's, but anyway, I'm glad to see you. And I love your office. It looks amazing. like a lot of movies.
There's a lot of stuff here, yes.
It's, I would describe to our listeners what I'm looking at behind you, Fisher, but I won't.
Is it too obscene? You know, so because I'm basically, I'm in my bedroom because my kids are doing homeschooling upstairs.
Yeah.
But is it too risque? All the
no, it's great. It's art.
It's great for radio.
It's great for radio. we're not gonna say a word about what we're looking at. This is just gonna be the great mystery for the listener.
All right, good. Okay,
what is he
good.
Sitting in front of? It's art, folks. It's art.
It's total art.
Tasteful art. Yeah.
We are. We're back. We've been off for a little while.
Where you been?
We've just been off. You know, where have you? We've been off.
We're in quarantine. We took our holiday. We're ending our holiday hiatus.
Yes. All right.
We've been off the internet.
You're our first guest for the new season.
Great. I feel honored. I feel excited. New year, new everything. Okay.
New regime, new everything.
We were waiting. The whole deal was we were waiting to see how the election went because Joe and I had a deal. If Biden won, I would go back to doing the show with him. But if Trump won, Joe's new co-host was going to be Randy Quaid.
Okay. Can I tell you my Randy Quaid story?
Sure. If you can, sure, yes.
It's not that exciting, except that I was in a movie with him, and we had, I believe she was a PA on the movie, but it was his soon-to-be wife, and he met her on the movie that I was in. Called Bloodhounds on Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's it.
Yeah, that's the story.
And
But Randy Quaid was a very different dude back then, and very different. I mean, geez.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, there's a number of people who've gone over to the dark side for whatever reasons later in their lives.
It's true. I also worked with Ron Silver and twice. Once when he was he went to the dark side. The last time I worked with him, it was
John Voight, same thing,
right?
I watched there was a not that new, but like a year ago, a new Blu-ray of Salvador, and it's so odd watching James Woods in a movie like that, or True Believer, and then recognizing the gap between who he's playing and who he is.
Yeah. But, wow. I know. Well. Anyway,
let's. hey, it's all over. The world's better. Everything's fixed. Let's move on. We haven't even. I don't even remember, Joe. We don't normally introduce our guests. We just go into it. And Joe always thinks we should introduce them, and I always maintain that our listeners, by the time they get here, know who we're talking to. But
But not if they're in their car.
Out of there, yes. No, we're here very excited. We're here with a young man who's done a bit of acting in his time and moved up to directing. He's done a ton of documentaries. I apologize. I was not, and I have seen some of them. I just hadn't connected them with any sort of. But we've got Fisher Stevens here. He's got a new film that is either about to come out or has just come out, if you're listening.
Depending on when you listen to this.
Depending on when you're listening, or came out years ago, if you're listening to us in the future.
It's an old movie already.
Jeez, remember that? I remember those days, I had hair, a little bit of hair.
It's Palmer, starring Justin Timberlake, and it's a lovely film. Congratulations. And you get some great performances. My wife and I were sitting there. Finally, it was like, she goes and terrible thing to say to a director that we did this in the middle of the film, but believe me, we were watching, we were paying attention. She said, "Who is that? Look them up." And I'm looking on IMDb, and I did not recognize Juno Temple at all. She's, yeah. That's a wild thing. I think when an actor shows up on set and looks and acts nothing like themselves, that's got to be disconcerting.
She is amazing. And that was Justin's and his manager, Rick Yorn's idea, Juno Temple, to play that part, because they had played in a movie that Woody Allen had directed called Wonder Wheel years before. And I guess when they read the script, they just thought of her. And I was like, oh, I would have never thought of her.
Yeah, it's not what you'd think of. I mean, she's terrific. But it's a lovely film, and of course, we never talk about our guests' work, so we're done there. But congratulations!
That was so nice. I liked that you called me a young man when you introduced me. That was really wonderful too. I already love your show.
Well, I think we're probably around the same age, so there's a lot of like.
Yeah, good. So
I'm working on my own issues there too.
So okay. Okay.
But Fisher, I actually realized walking in, normally I know what they're going to, I don't know what you came here to talk about. I know you want to talk about movies.
Yeah.
Did you come up with
You know, I came up with a list of 10 movies, but it's 10 is a tough number, obviously.
I know. It's hard to winnow it down to 10, isn't it?
Wow.
Down, or was it getting it down that was hard, or getting it?
No, getting it down. I mean, I thought of like 30 actually. I'll jump right in. You know what's great about this is that I actually revisited a few of them in the last 24 hours. Just
oh great,
not the whole film, but just and the other great thing about this is when you ask someone to name 10 movies. You start going into your library and you just realize how many amazing films there are. And you get excited that you're in the business, and then you feel good about what you, and it was, I love the assignment, and I'm grateful you guys invited me on, because it just got me.
Oh, fantastic.
It's been uplifting.
Ready. Yeah. So far it's been very uplifting. Yeah. You may hate my films and think I'm I'm bringing up some bad movies, but anyway.
No, you can. That's the thing about this show is that you could. It's called The Movies That Made Me. They don't have to be good movies that made you. They could be Ed Wood movies, but in a lot of ways, sometimes those pictures are very resonant, and they lead you to think about other pictures and other things. And that's why it's so hard to winnow it down to 10 pictures, because every time you think of one, you go, "Oh, but the guy also made this, and then there's that, and then that leads to this," and you know, before you know it, you're like putting your head in a bucket, you know.
I know. But it did make me also just want to watch movies.
That's fantastic.
And now's the time.
Well, I know. Thank God I'm doing a lot of interviews and press, and I just can't. But anyway, you want me to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, let's start. So these are kind of films that mean a lot to you that have.
Yeah.
That, okay, cool. Just jump in, however, in whatever sequence you want to go in.
Well, the first one I'll start with is very relevant to today, and I've been obsessed with this movie forever, but it does definitely will resonate. It's A Face in the Crowd, directed by Ilya Kazan, written by Bud Schulberg. Bud Schulberg has always been one of my idols and my heroes. That movie, obviously the reality TV star becoming a political animal, it's just incredibly resonant. And you watch it now and you're like, holy shit, it's crazy, you know?
Yeah.
But what's amazing about that picture is that, at the end of the movie until the election, it's one of my favorite movies. And I could watch it anytime, any place. But when you get to the end and Walter Matthau makes his speech about how we always catch on, how the public always catches on, and you know, you can fool some of the people, but in the end, we always get the drop on them. And I'm thinking, this ending isn't true anymore.
Yeah, give me a rewrite.
It's not happening. this is the one thing in the movie that wasn't prescient. And now, as it turns out, it's back. The ending is back. It's still a great ending. And it's even more meaningful.
Yeah, you still have 35 million Americans or so believing the election was not. But we have time to make them understand that democracy does. But the thing about Bud Schulberg you know, On the Waterfront, my favorite book of all time, What Makes Sammy Run, you know, fighting for every man, fighting for justice. And it's just, he was so prescient, and it's a beautifully shot, beautifully acted. I mean, God, and to see Andy Griffith go from that to the Andy Griffith Show, it's just, it's bizarre. I don't know. I'm wondering, Joe, if you know, or Josh, like why, like his career could have gone a very different way after Face of the Crowd than Andy.
Well, but Face of the Crowd was not a hit. Not only was it not a hit, it was a fiasco. And I think that he probably was told that, you know, No Time for Sergeants is what the kind of stuff you should be doing. And, you know, he didn't do a lot of dramas until later in his life, because that was his big shot. He was great in it. And it did not catch the public's fancy, needless to say, because the public were portrayed as generally as boobs in it. And, you know, that one scene, what they call the Uncle Don scene, where based on the idea of a kid show host who swore on the radio after he thought the mic was off. That'll hold the little bastard, and that ended his career. So Bud based the scene where they hear Lonesome Rhodes actually talking about what he really believes, and then it cuts to a whole bunch of shots of different people going, "What are you kidding me?" And then they instantly turn on him, which I think is a little bit facile, but it's very satisfying.
Yeah, it is,
yeah. Well, it's always fascinating to me too. Trailer popped up the other day and I hadn't seen it in a while, but yeah, that was, you know, because it was Griffith's first film, and in the trailer, I don't know if you watched it, Fisher, or you looked at the film, he is introduced as being, you know, the hot new discovery from the guy who brought you Marlon Brando and James Dean.
Oh my God, no, I didn't see
and
that.
you watch that film independent of any Andy Griffith baggage, which I guess you wouldn't have, Joe. He wasn't like famous.
He wouldn't. He did radio stuff.
Yeah, you'd be like, holy shit, look at this guy. Yeah, here's another one of those. You know, it makes you wonder what would happen to Brando if, like, his first film had bombed. Would he be a
right? Would he have been Brando? Well, it's funny. I made a documentary for Netflix called The Confidence Man about Trump that I started right after the election, and I interview the producer and the editor of The Apprentice, not Mark Burnett, but one of the main producers. And this producer had tape. He was the famous producer that texted, tweeted, like, if you heard the things what Donald
said,
Trump was,
yeah, you heard what he said. Really saying, yeah,
and he had death threats and all that. But I kept waiting for that moment of Trump to, like, leave the mic on and really people who voted for him to really hear what he thinks about them. But it never happened. So anyway, that movie really is a brilliant piece of art, I believe. And
it's so good. Do either of you, do you even know this was happening? There was a couple of years ago, there was supposed to be Elvis Costello was writing the songs for a musical version.
Yes.
I haven't heard anything about it in a long time now.
Yeah. Patrick Wilson, the actor, was playing Andy Griffith in the musical workshop, I know. I don't know what happened with that. I do know that in the 80s, Don Johnson was going to play that part, and Whoopi Goldberg was going to play Patricia O'Neill.
Really?
And that movie fell apart. But I know that they actually were almost in prep for that film at one point when Don Johnson.
Oh, it was a film. For the film,
For the film. But the musical, I don't know. You know, I think. I don't know what's happening with it. I know Patrick's wife, Dag, she's working with me on Succession. And she told me that he had done the workshop and said the music was incredible. Of course, with Elvis.
Yeah, you would think.
You should encourage her to encourage him.
Yeah, I know. It's a great idea, especially now.
And sorry, you're directing on Succession?
No, I'm acting.
Okay, fantastic.
Yeah.
Absolutely love that show.
Good.
Well, cool. Well, what's next? What do you got?
Well, you know, another film that I would say another film that I was loved and always is one of my tops is Lolita, the original with James Mason and Shelley Winters and Sue Lyons. So and Peter Sellers, like, who's like one of my heroes. I had to put a Peter Sellers movie. I couldn't decide Dr. Strangelove or that, or there's so many Peter Sellers. I love Peter Sellers, Peter Sellers is just one of my gods, my acting gods. That movie is just so crazy. The opening, from the opening to the where it goes, and James Mason's acting, me being an actor, I just think that guy is one of the greatest, most unsung greatest actors that ever lived. And that performance in particular, and Shelley Winter, I mean, it's just an actor's beast. And Kubrick, I remember like there are these long takes, like it's not very cutty. He played out really long scenes, and it's just, oh my God, Mason's madness, the way she drives him mad. I don't know. And it's beautifully shot again, the beautiful black and white, Kubrick being a photographer, just the long hallway. I don't know. So I'd say, I don't know, Joe and Josh, you guys can probably school me on what a bit about when they were making it. And I think that was Kubrick's like fifth film or fourth film. I'm not sure, but it's a masterpiece in my opinion.
That was the one where he decided that he was going to make movies in Britain, whether they were set in America or not. And there is a second unit that went to America to shoot a bunch of exteriors. But for the most part, most of the exteriors are actually interiors. You know, the scenes in the backyard and all that stuff. Those are all on stages, but they're really, they're really well lit, and you kind of can't tell. But Peter Sellers is particularly amusing in that picture because he's the villain, and he also has a scene with Mason outside on a porch in the hotel,
Peter Sellers,
where he does a Stanley Kubrick impression for the entire scene.
Is that what it
scene.
Is?
Yes.
I was trying to figure out like the Bronx accent.
No,
where did he get
doing. He's doing Kubrick brilliantly.
I found that out doing the show, talking to Joe, because that might be my favorite Peter Sellers scene of all time. It's the creepiest, funniest thing I've ever seen. He just makes your.
Well, he's pretending he's a policeman. I'm a policeman.
Yeah,
I'm with
that.
Normal guy.
He's really stooping the girl, but But I also am a huge fan of Peter Sellers, but you have to take into account the fact that the man was absolutely mad. And if you see the documentary Ghost in the Noonday Sun, which is by Peter Medak, which is a movie that that Sellers scuttled basically. And it's a fascinating. I believe it's on Netflix.
The doc is called The Ghost of Peter Sellers. It's Netflix or Hulu. And it's about the making of Ghost in the Noonday Sun.
And when you look at this footage, which is, it obviously wasn't going to be a very good movie anyway. But the lengths that Sellers went to sabotage himself and everyone else is just shocking. I mean, there's a good bio about him, which I can't remember the title of also, which is full of a lot of incidents of self-sabotage. But he was a genius. And I guess sometimes the price of being a genius is that, you know, you're nuts.
Yeah, he was. Wait, Peter Medak is a Hungarian filmmaker?
Yeah. And I apologize. It's on Amazon Prime. I just checked.
Okay, Amazon Prime. Goes to Peter Sellers. No, Peter Medak's daughter, I had played my girlfriend in The Marrying Man, Karen Medak. And I had never heard of him. And she told me at the time about her dad. And I haven't heard his name or her name for a while, but now I'm excited.
Well, he's actually done some really interesting movies.
Great movies,
That's what I heard. I can't wait to.
The Ruling Class is a masterpiece. Yeah. And they did that. Oh, he did crime films. Yeah.
He did The Ruling Class?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
and,
shit.
Okay. And then he did this spate of great crime films in like the 90s. He did The Craze, the one where Spandau Ballet played the two British gangsters. And then he did.
I love The Craze. I didn't even put it together.
Yeah. Okay. And then Let Him Have It, which is a great film about public execution in England. Incredibly powerful stuff. And I know him a little bit through, I guess, the Masters of Horror dinners we go to, but.
Because he did The Changeling also.
He did The Changeling with George C. Scott.
Oh, wow. Wow. What a career.
Yeah. And he's still, every time I hear his name, I have this whiff of sadness because the early 90s, my very first movie, first script I ever wrote and sold was supposed to be directed by him with Gabriel Byrne and Stephen Ray in the leads. And then there were a few bumps in the road and it ended up starring, a very young Casper Van Dien and being directed by a let's say not Peter Medak director. went straight to video. So,
I've had a lot of those experiences.
Oh yeah, man. I've had plenty since then, but that was the first.
Yeah. Well, take comfort in the fact that now everything is straight to video.
Exactly. Yes. But true. Lolita is so I was a kid when I first saw that film, probably on TV, and you know, I didn't know the book, I didn't know any of this stuff, and it's such an odd film, especially if you're coming in from a vacuum, you know. But the tonality of it is something I'm obsessed with. It just feels like you're living in another time in a way that so many movies from other times don't quite. It just makes me want to live in, like, what is it, 1962?
And that small town, which now you're telling me was in probably England, but yeah, supposed to be New Hampshire. Shropshire. Yes. And like, why wasn't James Mason just doing more? I don't know. It's funny because his career, obviously, he's like a legend, and you think of him in almost the same sentence as Olivier, but not quite. But you know, but like he never like I want. I wish he did more. I just wish there were more James Mason movies.
Listen, when I was a kid, he was Captain Nemo, and from then on, I was a fan.
Right,
Captain Nemo.
God, he has got. I think my favorite line reading of all time is, oh my God, what's the Sherlock Holmes movie with Christopher Plummer?
Murder by Decree.
He plays Watson. Christopher Plummer is Holmes, and they're looking for Jack the Ripper. And there's a wonderful scene where James Mason is eating dinner, and he's chasing the last pea around a plate with his fork, and it's not getting on the fork. And Holmes walks over to him, and he just takes the fork, and he goes, he mushes the pea, and hands it to James Mason. And James Mason looks at him with this hangdog look.
You squashed my pee. Well, now you've got a corner. Yeah, but squashing your fingers pee. I'm just trying to help. I didn't want it squashed. I didn't like it that way.
Yeah.
He's also great in a movie called Bigger Than Life, which is a Nick Ray movie from the 50s about a family man who takes too much cortisone.
Cortisone? Was that,
The doctor prescribes a lot of cortisone. He starts abusing it, and he gets a god complex. And there's some of the most shocking 50s imagery in that movie. At one point, when he announces to the family that God was wrong, and it's a pretty chilling movie, actually.
Wow. All right. I'm writing that one down. Wow. Okay. That's great. All right. Well, Lolita, what a movie. And great Sue stuff. Lyons. Oh. She's so beautiful.
And she's really good at it. And I think she deserved a better career, she worked for John Ford, and she worked for a lot of famous people in less interesting roles. And I guess her life was kind of bumpy and ultimately tragic, but she's really terrific in that movie.
Yeah. And Night of the Iguana too. She's wonderful in.
Right.
I love that show.
Right. Yeah. Well, now I'm going to change my list because you guys got me in a job.
You're not supposed to change your list.
All right. I was just going to.
You can only change once a day.
You're augmenting your list.
Okay. Well, I was going to because you got me into John Huston, and I was going to my 11th or 12th film. Anyway, maybe I'll save it. I know I was going to put Fat City on my list, but.
Oh, wow.
Let's do it. Let me just say Fat City, because it really influenced me with making my film, Palmer. And I have to say that I made Timberlake watch it like 3 times. And my DP, we all watched it. So I'm going to just put it on the list, because I have to say, as a documentarian, and watching the way Huston captured that California town and those people, the real people, he obviously put long lenses on and captured real people in life. And Stacy Keach, oh my God.
Susan Terrell.
Susan Terrell. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I just think that movie is so painfully beautiful. And John Huston made that. That was sort of like near the later part of his life.
It was toward the later, it was one of his last films.
Right.
And the way it opens with that song, I don't know, man. I just think that movie is so underrated and so powerful. And
it's grim.
Grim.
It's
I know.
Grim.
I picked a grim.
I've been meaning to go back to it. In fact, I think Criterion just came out with it a while back and I got it and I've not watched it.
You haven't been in the mood.
When will you be? I guess I'm in the mood now. I'll probably end up watching it tonight after this. I got to work with Susan years ago and got to know her pretty well. She gave me a kitten. Fascinating, incredible, incredible woman. Just brilliant and funny and filthy.
What about that performance though? Was there any Oscar nominations?
She was nominated. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that's the only time. And she deserved better. So we keep talking about actresses who deserve better. That's I guess that's almost by definition, isn't it? In this town.
Well, especially when they pass a certain age.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We watched, for some reason, a friend of mine and I watched Angel again recently, the dopey drive-in movie about the teenage hooker. And Susan Terrell and Dick Shawn are in it playing a couple of sort of street characters. And I realized we all had the same experience. We'd just forgotten everything about the movie except for them because the movie's completely forgettable. But they're right. So good. It's like someone didn't tell them they're in a crappy drive-in movie because you can just watch the two of them. Dick Shawn plays a transvestite prostitute and Susan Terrell's this eccentric artist. And they're so good together.
And what about Stacy Keach at that point in his career? Because that was like a big role for a big, I mean, like, do you think he went to like McQueen first or someone like that? And then,
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway. Well then let's lighten it up a little bit. Because I did just watch this documentary on John Belushi, and then I went back and watched Animal House again. And I just remember that Animal House is like a masterpiece in so many ways. And how much it influenced my acting. You know, I was 19 when I did this movie, or 20, My Science Project. And I remember just kind of trying to steal John Belushi takes in Animal House and just going, I laugh so hard and it still holds up. And you think about how many actors came out of that. It I don't know, man, that movie is just still fantastic. So I would say that's one of the best comedies. I don't know what year, I can't remember what year it was, 79 or something?
78.
I had that experience a while back of going to see it again. And because so many movies from that era and of that type have not aged well for a lot of reasons.
Right.
But so few of them are actually really well-directed movies. I remember sitting there thinking, you know, the time may come when I've seen it so often, none of the jokes land for me at all. And it will still be a pleasurable film.
You know, you could never be a studio executive because the whole way that they look at comedies is, yeah, it was funny the first time. It's not funny now. Take it out.
Oh, Jesus. God. No, it's so good. And that amazing score and just.
Yeah. I mean, and there's Toga Party came out of that. Otis Day and the Nights came out of that.
Yes. You
know, I'm a Zit came out of that. And then, you know, people like Bruce McGill and Kevin Bacon and Peter Rieger and like, oh my God, it was an incredible film. And I couldn't believe, like you said, like how you still just can't stop laughing.
Yeah. Oh my God, the horse.
Oh, Niedermeyer. That guy was fucking great.
He's an archetype now. That's dude's a Niedermeyer.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I would argue that both of the Trump juniors are Niedermeyers in training.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah, so
great film. Great film.
Okay. Yeah, that one is just really. All right. I'm gonna go with something that I discovered by mistake on Criterion a few months ago in quarantine. It's a long, beautiful Cuban movie called Lucia by a guy named Solas. I think it's Hector Solas. And what it is I think it was made in right after the revolution, but it's three stories of the Cuban three Cuban revolutions, the 1890s, the 1920s, and then the Castro. And it's called Lucia. And it's in three parts. I got to tell you, there's a scene, there's a battle scene in this movie. Like, it's the Mexican Civil War when it was in Cuba. It's one of the most profound, they're native, like indigenous people fighting against troops. The native indigenous people are naked on horseback, basically. Thousands of them. Like, it's the biggest. I don't know how I never heard of this movie. Yeah, you guys should check it out. It's called Lucia. And I would love to talk to you guys after, not on offline, after you see it and see what you think. But it if you have Criterion, it's on that. And it's a lot about, it's about this, the three women named Lucia, three generations of Lucia. And it's a historical Cuban film that just blew my mind. Oh, Marty Scorsese. The reason I watched it was like Marty Scorsese Presents, one of those.
Oh, one of those.
So he's aggregated a whole bunch of those pictures that he thinks people should see.
Right. And he restored it, or he was responsible for the restoration.
Do you know the film, Joe?
No.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Right off the bat, first episode of the year, we've stumped Joe.
Well,
I don't know.
There is no reason to. I think it's a very underappreciated film, and I was glued to it. And the acting is incredible. And these women, they're three different Lucias, and they're all just magnificent. So, anyway,
that's like, I love that. I love that kind of thing when you watch something like that.
That's what this show is for.
Yeah,
great. Okay, another film that it really inspired me also for Palmer. I watched it many times. Was Paper Moon. Mm. Peter Bogdanovich, I believe it was his third film, maybe.
It was the one.
It was after Last Picture Show.
It was after Last Picture Show, but it was. Was it after What's Up, Doc, or before?
I think it was before, because I think What's Up, Doc was 72. I think this was 71, maybe. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
That sounds right.
73.
Okay. But I, when I read the script to Palmer, it really reminded me of the boy just had, there was a similar vibe to Tatum O'Neill in Paper Moon. So I felt like I wanted my character, my boy, to be that good, you know? And I've had the good fortune to have met Peter Bogdanovich a few times. And I called him before I started shooting. And I was like, hey, Peter, listen, I know it was a long time ago, but I wanted to know if you'd talk to me a little bit about Tatum and directing a kid. And he's like, yeah. And it was literally like the guy had finished making the film like a year ago. You know, it was like, yeah. And I'm like, well, can you give me some advice? Because I have a 7-year-old who's my lead, basically opposite Justin. And he's like, yeah. And then he told me that the most important things he did for directing Tatum was, one, he'd get down on her level and always look her in the eye and direct her always from her level. And two, he treated Tatum like an adult actor, but also knowing never to try to lose her confidence, keeping her confident, but at the same time, not coddling to her. And then he said, three, I never let Ryan talk to her. I kept Ryan away from her in terms of directing. They go home together and stuff like that, but I never wanted him to give her a direction on the set. And it was very good. But anyway, so I love the film. I mean, Madeline Kahn, just amazing. The production design, the way he shot the film, the way he had Tatum's point of view. I mean, there were definitely moments where I stole ideas from that movie, from my film, in terms of where to place the camera at times. And I just, oh God, the humor in that movie and the performance, that girl was just, I mean, I don't know. I think she was 9 or 10. She was just.
Well, yeah, there's scenes in there where it's just, the camera's just on her too. They're not cutting away and building a performance with a couple lines, which is usually how you get around a 9-year-old actor. It's, she's incredible in that film. And which reminds me, I was not to downplay my response, but I guess we should, I want to talk about the kid in your movie for a minute, even though we're not supposed to do that, because I thought he was terrific. My wife is obsessed with this child now, so she'd kill me if I didn't ask you at least, where did you find him?
Yeah, so I auditioned like 300 kids, and he, Justin had said, Timberlake, he's like, I'll read with as many as you want, but I need at least six. I need six. Six is the number. No five, no four. I want to, and if you have 10, I'll read with 10. So I had five kids, and they were very different. They were older, some of them, and more gender. You couldn't tell one or two of them if they were boys or girls, you know. And then I needed a sixth kid, and there was always Ryder, but he was seven. He was younger. Child labor laws would have made it really hellacious to cast him because I get less time with a seven-year-old than an eight-year-old and a nine-year-old. Every year you get more time. But I threw him in at the last minute, thank goodness. And as soon as Timberlake read with him, it was very clear that those two guys, that was our boy. And the other thing is that they just had this instant thing that they did, which is they listened to each other. They listened. And I noticed that most kids don't listen when they act. They're always ahead. Ryder was incredibly in the moment. So we just got so lucky, and he'd never acted before, really. Oh, I won't. That's not true. He had no lines in a Law and Order episode playing one of the Menendez brothers at six. And
there's a credit.
Yeah. And he had no lines in a commercial where he just kind of, you know, like ate Jell-O or something. That was wow. It. Never done.
Nice. He's fantastic.
So did you get around your age problems by having a double to shoot with?
Yes. But it ended up very, very rarely did it work, unfortunately. You know, it was, Ryder was so, and the way I filmed a lot was a lot in one take, or just the way that I made the movie, there wasn't a lot of opportunity to use the double, but I did have one. I had an acting coach for him on set, which really helped because we shot the film in 25 days. And, you know, when you only have the kid for 6 hours a day, it's, and he's in almost every scene, it was really challenging. So it was like a puzzle putting together the schedule, knowing that we only had him for a certain amount of time. And I wish the double had worked out more, but it just, you know, it was, there's not a lot of backs of heads or, you know, and because Justin, you know, there's a couple moments when we'd send him home. And if it was a single on Justin, where we'd have either the double read or someone else. But that, yeah, I thought we could do more of that. And that was really tricky because of the way the movie was designed.
Yeah, they work great together. I mean, and that movie lives or dies on just the feeling between the two of them. And it's just beautiful. It's
beautiful. Oh, thanks. Yeah, I would have been sunk.
Yeah.
All right. Well, another movie that I'm sure you, Joe, and you probably know a lot more about how it was made than me, which is a classic film, but always been one of my inspirations, is Sullivan's Travels. Preston Sturges, Joel McRae.
Oh, yeah.
And I always love that because, you know, especially, and again, if you look at that movie today, it has a lot of resonance. You know, a guy, you know, a filmmaker who tries to live his life like subjects and hates making comedies and then realizes what he's given. But that those scenes with when he, you know, becomes a homeless person, a hobos back then they would call it. And I don't know, there's just, Sturges has always been, you know, we could have put three or four of his movies in this list, but this one just really affected me when I saw it. And when I see it again, it just had, I don't know, it just lives with me when I make movies, I guess.
Well, that's one of the movies along with Face in the Crowd that every so often you read that somebody is going to remake. Mm. There have been all these attempts. Well, I said, you know, remake a Sullivan's Travel, because people, they'll look at it and they'll say, wow, this is really good. Let's remake it. And there are certain movies that resist being remade. And there are a number of movies that were remade that should never have been remade. And there's some other movies that were remade where it's the remake that we remember and not the original. But but Sullivan's Travels has such a uniqueness to it. And a lot of it has to do with Sturges and his writing and his long takes, you know. I mean, the opening scene in the office is like this, it's like runs a whole reel, you know, right. and it's all choreographed so that you don't have to have cuts and you don't have to have close-ups, and the dialogue is rapid fire and it's really funny. It's an amazing film. It's, I, you know, it's the best, I think it's the best film Veronica Lake ever made.
Was that considered innovative then, the way he shot that opening?
I think not many people were doing that. No, but that was why he wanted to direct, is because he was watching directors make a hash, he thought, of the scripts that he wrote. And so he went, okay, well, I'm going to do this myself. And he did his first picture for $1. You know, he said, I'll direct this picture. I'll give you this script and I'll direct the picture for $1, if you let me direct it. And that was The Great McGinty. And which is not, I don't think, one of his best pictures, but nonetheless, it's the movie that it put him over. And, you know, Veronica Lake, he was so difficult to work with that Joel McRae refused to work with her again after that picture.
Really?
When she made I Married a Witch with Frederick March, they hated each other so much that it was like hard to conceive when you see the movie, which is really excellent. They're so professional. I mean, the performances are so good that you can't tell that they were doing terrible things to each other. She was putting weights in her clothing when he picked her up so that to make him mad. I mean, she was really quite something, apparently. And I'm sure there must be a bio about her, a book about her.
Wow.
But you know, she became particularly famous because she worked with Alan Ladd, who was the same size as she was, which is very rare, you know. And then she had the peekaboo hair and the whole thing. And she was cute. I mean, she was a good actress, but apparently she was really a nightmare.
Oh, I've never heard this. I'm so sad.
Yeah, I love Veronica Lake.
I'm always amazed by that. You know, when you hear that enough, that it's a thing. I mean, I can't imagine as an actor having to get up every morning and pretend to be just cheerfully in love with someone who I want to murder.
Yeah, that's acting.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah. Fisher, I won't ask you specifics, but I mean, have you found yourself in that situation? Simple yes or no. Well,
oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I won't say the movie, and it's a movie nobody saw, but I had to do a sex scene with an actress that I couldn't stand and did not. And I'm, oh my God, it was a nightmare.
Well, luckily it wasn't a porno, so you didn't have to.
Yeah, exactly. How do you know, Joe? I haven't known you for years. You don't know about it. Yeah.
Joe's seen every frame you've ever been in.
Thank God you missed that one. Anyway.
move on.
Yeah, moving on. Okay, another movie that I just recently watched that is a classic, and I watched it also because of what was going on in our country, but it's still amazing, is Do the Right Thing. Which I couldn't believe when I watched it again after, you know, George Floyd and Eric Garner, and just how prescient. And by the way, it's a great movie anyway. And my next door neighbor is Rosie Perez in real life, my great friend. So I see Rosie, I talk to her, and I've always loved that film. A little bitter and angry I wasn't ever cast in a Spike Lee movie, but I think that movie is a masterpiece, and it's even better now when you watch it 25 years later. And I live in Fort Greene now, and you know, it's crazy like how much has changed and how little things have changed. Mm-hmm. But the filmmaking itself, the opening with her, you know.
Yeah.
And the acting is just incredible. I mean, Sam Jackson in that movie, man, that's what I think. Anyway, I love that film, and
it's glorious. Really, it's really glorious movie. I remember seeing it. I can tell you, I saw it in Westwood like the week it came out, and you know, Spike had made some good movies, and you're like, okay, yeah, this will be fun. This will be cool. But just right off the bat, it just announces it's something different. And yeah, every time I go back to it, it's like, did it diminish in my memory, or is it just better every time? You know what I mean? It's incredible film and incredible look at it. Just Ernest did such an incredible job of capturing heat on film. I can't think of another movie that
it's a great point. You know, yeah,
maybe Lawrence going across the, what is it called, God's Anvil, that might be the only hotter scene in movies that but yeah, I love it so much, and I'm obsessed with the fact that like Spike called up Chuck D and said, give me the greatest rap anthem of all time, and Chuck D said, when do you need it? Delivered it.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that film, man.
Yeah.
Okay. Then, well, I have to put a Scorsese picture in, and you know, that was tough, but because I'd say the movie I've seen more than any other movie in my life is Raging Bull. So I'd say I've seen Raging Bull more than, yeah, any other movie. I never get tired of watching it. I have a personal connection to it. That's so stupid, but, I was thinking, well, how can I sound interesting talking about Raging Bull when it's been discussed? But I want to hear more what you guys have to say.
But what's your personal connection?
Well, it's the dumbest thing. But basically, I was a 13-year-old kid living in the meatpacking district in a loft in Greenwich Village, or 14 at the time. And my mother, or maybe it was 14 or 15, and I had decided I was going to be an actor by this point, or you know, studying. And my mother told me that Robert De Niro was coming to look at buying our loft because we were broke. We needed to sell this loft in the meatpacking. And he's playing this boxer and he wants a loft to turn it into a gym. And she said, we're even discussing possibly turning part of the loft into a gym and keeping our bedroom so we can, you know, still live here. I said, oh my God. I cut school. She let me stay home from school in bed pretending I was sick. And when he came over to look at our loft for a Raging Bull to buy, and it didn't work out, but I did get to meet. That was the first time I met Robert De Niro.
And you got to perform for him because you were acting sick.
That's right.
Exactly. Exactly.
And did he figure out you were acting, or did he see no scenes?
Exactly. He didn't even know I was acting.
Oh, you convinced him.
Yeah. There you go. There you go.
I did screen test with him for, I was testing for Once Upon a Time in America to play one of those kids. And I told him that story. It didn't help. I didn't get the job. But let's just say that movie, you know, come on. I mean, it's still, I still try to understand how he made that movie. Like, how that movie came, I don't know. It's perfect to me in so many ways, but everything about it.
It's remarkable how many black and white movies you have mentioned, I'm all for it. Most of my favorite movies are black and white.
Yeah, well, your podcast, you know, these are the movies that really make me feel, and these are the movies that have influenced me for sure. And I think in a weird way, you're right. It's like, maybe I'm reminiscent of the past. You know, all the stuff we looked at to prep for Palmer there were two modern movies we looked at. One was called Mustang, which is a movie.
Which is good.
Matthias Kinhorst.
Really good. Matthias, yes. And the other was called Rider.
That's awesome.
Rider, yeah. Which is a great movie. If you haven't seen it, Josh, it's amazing. Rider was supposed to be a documentary. It was this woman who's now actually directing a $200 million Marvel movie. She just did Nomadland.
Oh, the Nomadland. Yeah.
So she had discovered this Native American rodeo in North Dakota, and she was going to make a documentary about this rodeo. And she went up there and started filming and realized, oh my God, I want to do something different. I want to write a movie based on your stories and have you guys act and do my lines. And that movie's beautiful. It's called Rider.
It's kind of, Nomadland kind of has that too, where there's a couple of movies.
Well, Nomadland, it's what's astonishing about Nomadland is the performances by the non-actors.
Yeah.
Right.
Often playing characters with their same names.
Yeah.
Doing long soliloquies that you assume are written. But then you think, well, it couldn't be written. It's almost like this guy is just telling me, or this woman particularly,
right. Yeah,
is telling me this life story, you know? And it's very moving, and much more so, I'm afraid, for me, than the part with the actors, you know?
Interesting. Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to see how she does with the Marvel film.
She's actually using real superheroes.
Yeah, she got the real people.
And they're going to talk about
that. Went to lives.
Krypton. Yeah, it actually worked out. Yeah.
That's the DC universe, Joseph.
Yeah, those are the only two contemporary films that I used for prep. And then I went deep into, I mean, we watched all the Dardenne brothers films. But another film that actually influenced me, and it's a little creepy and weird film, but I don't know, it just had a profound effect on me, was Murmur of the Heart by Louis Malle. I wanted to put a French film on the list, and I was toying between, because I love Truffaut and Godard's early stuff, and I definitely was affected by those French films, and always have wanted to direct something in Paris. I acted in a film in Paris. It was just another one of my unforgettable movies that I was in. But this film in particular, it's set in 54 during when French invaded Indochina. It was called then Vietnam. But it was shot in 71. And it obviously deals with adolescent sex and sexuality, and family and class is a big part of it, you know? And I just was like blown away by the it's so brave, that film. And Louis Malle is just, I fucking love Louis Malle, man. It's such a tragedy he died so young, because you could tell he would have had another 10 great films at least. But anyway, I don't know if you guys saw it. I'm sure you've seen it, but that film just blows my mind. It's just really deep. It's in color, but it's very muted colors, very, you know. But
it's okay if we talk about movies in color. They don't have to all be in black and white.
Well, back to that comment, what's interesting is that two of the black and white movies he's mentioned were films that were made in the color era. So yes. they're distinctly black and white.
And Raging Bull.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is interesting. I know of the Malle film. I have never seen it. I have to
admit. Oh, you should see it.
But yeah.
It's a gap.
Yes. Yeah. No, he's magnificent. I don't know that one.
Joe, I was wondering, it's another, you know, film with a young actor. It's like, it's an incredible, incredible performance. I don't know the boy's name, but I'm wondering whatever happened to that boy.
From Murmur of the Heart?
Yeah.
I don't think he was a professional.
Right. He didn't seem possible. He was so, I don't know, that guy was... That kid was just unbelievable. I love those movies. I could just, you know, that's what I'm saying about what you guys had me do. Then I was just like, I just want to watch all Louis Malle's films. And I just want to watch all Truffaut's films. And I want to, you know.
Too many movies, I think, finally.
Sorry?
Too many movies, I think, is the problem.
It used to be too many movies, not enough time.
Yeah.
Now there's too many movies, but there's still not enough time, but there's a lot more time.
It's the downside of the show is I literally have three movies now that I want to watch tonight. We plan to watch something else and we'll never get to them. And I think people just need to stop. I think really is what happens.
Stop making them.
Stop making movies for a while so I can catch up.
Well, we sort of did. I think there were a lot less movies made last year than the year
before. There are fewer coming out this coming year, I think, probably, than in the past few years. Yes, I would wager.
What is that poster behind you with the yellow poster? Is that Josh?
Sweet Smell of Success.
Okay, that's okay. So that's
on your list?
That's on my list. It's another black and white, but that is that was like my 11. I think I've done 10 maybe, but Sweet Smell of Success. And I was looking at that and I was like, is that Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis? Yeah.
They're a cookie full of arsenic.
Yeah. Match me, Sydney.
There it is, yes.
Do a lot of people,
Sydney, I want to chastise you.
Oh.
Cats in the bag, bags in the river.
What a movie, man. Do a lot of people pick that?
Actually, it's been fairly popular.
It's come up.
Yeah, no, that's why it wasn't in my top 10, because I was like, I'm sure these guys have talked about this movie. Had not many times.
Yeah, but probably not as often as I've seen it.
Yeah.
right.
And the fun thing is getting sort of the individual takes on it, because it's sort of one of the things we try very hard to get away from is kind of, you know, the academic approach to film. And the more people have something to say about a film that they're, you know, that is unique to them.
And every so often they'll surprise you. You know, a part of one of the adjuncts to the podcast is the website Trailers from Hell, where we have these, you know, trailers with people talking about, filmmakers talking about the movies that they liked. And it's always interesting when somebody comes on, like I think it was Mark Pellington came on and did a diatribe about why he doesn't like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And I can't say that I agreed with what he had to say, but it was kind of refreshing to like get a different perspective on something that we all have sort of ingrained opinions on, and that there's a sort of holy grail about what these movies are and who likes them and what they're good at. And every so often somebody comes with a pin and just sort of punctures it. And it's interesting, you know?
Yeah, I like that. But nobody can puncture Sweet Smell of Success.
No.
It's really great.
And it would be wrong to try.
Yeah.
It would be a sin.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
Yeah, no, it's such a lovely film. Such a lovely film. Wait, well, are you saying we've done 10 already?
I believe that's,
yeah, we did, Lord. But we gave as good as we got.
I have one more. I had one more. Oh, right. I had to include Coppola, but I was like Conversation or Apocalypse Now, because The Godfather's, that's another. So I put Apocalypse Now. I haven't seen the, I saw the redo.
And but not the re-redo.
There's various variants.
Right. So I haven't seen the various variant, but, it's funny, we were working on the set doing Succession the other day, and to get us all jacked up, you know, just as a warm-up, one of the actors brought in a boombox and we played Ride of the Valkyries. And so I decided to ask all the young actors on the set, what does this song mean to you? And not one of the youngsters, by the way, this wasn't the principals that you see, this is like more of the, you know, day players and background artists, but not one of them could name, not one of them said Apocalypse Now. I'm like, what? They didn't even see the movie. No one had seen the movie. Nobody under 30. They were bored.
Yeah.
No, you got to realize that the upcoming generation has not had the opportunity, and I'm being charitable, the opportunity to see movies in the situations and in the bulk that we were able to do as we were growing up. And so as a result, they have to have things pointed out to them. That's why we do the podcast. That's why we do the website. If you don't know about something, then, you know, you can't have an opinion about it. And right. As famous as some of these movies are to us, and as meaningful as they were in our lives, they just don't mean anything to some of the people who are coming up now, because it's outside their frame of reference. It's just not something that's part of the way they grew up. And as we all know, one of the reasons that we are who we are is because of the influences that we had while we were growing up. And so many of the movies that people talk about on this show are movies that they saw when they were younger. Yeah. And it really, you know, resonated with them and made them think and sent them thinking and creating in different directions than they would have had they not encountered them. But if you don't have the opportunity to experience them, then, you know, it's like a language you don't know.
Yeah, and another day of cutting school was cutting school with my great friend Josh Cox in high school, getting a joint and taking the train up to the Ziegfeld Theater and seeing Apocalypse Now when it first came out. Sitting there in the back and just like going, oh, you know, like serious memories, you know, like
yeah.
The Ziegfeld is gone, and you know, yeah, like you said, Joe, it's like, yeah.
The new version, I'll say it's worth seeing if you love the film, just because it's interesting to see him play around with it. But he is not, you know, it's, you're still going to go back to the original cut. Yeah, he can leave it alone. I will say this: we talked about this. I did watch his recut of Godfather 3 recently, which just came out, and I really liked it. My wife Nancy had never seen Godfather 3, and she's watching it. She's going, yeah, it's not the Godfather, but why do people hate this movie?
It got better.
It did get better, I think so.
No, he changed it around, though.
Yeah, he changed it.
This is a recut. It's got different footage, got a different ending.
Yeah.
I guess I guess there are times when he wasn't satisfied with it, but it went out anyway. And we've all had movies that did that. And some of us are lucky enough that the stuff still exists and somebody wants to pay for going back and reconstituting it. But for the most part, nobody does. And all that stuff gets thrown away. So we're most of the time we're stuck with the Magnificent Ambersons version that we have.
Right. We're not going to get
another one.
I think he knows something because, you know, every time he's recut Apocalypse Now, the original cut is still available and it's usually they're packaged together and it looks just as good. But with the new Godfather 3, you know, that's now the new version. I think he understands.
Oh, that's what he learned that from Lucas.
Well, yeah, but he didn't do that with a new kind of Apocalypse Now. I think he knows that he has genuinely improved Godfather 3, and I think he knows that Apocalypse Now is a masterpiece all on its own. Don't fuck with it. But
yeah, why? Because when I remember paying to go back to the Ziegfeld to see the redo, because back then the Ziegfeld was still open, and I was like, huh?
Good place this? To see it. Yeah.
But this is what...
Yeah.
But it had more Playboy bunnies, didn't it?
Yeah.
It did. It was
there you are.
Of all the movies that you don't need to add, you know, attractive naked women to, it's like a, you know, one of those grueling films about Vietnam is probably top of the list, I think.
Yeah, it's an incredible film that takes you on these constant journeys in one movie. And you know, the tiger scene, I just was on the safari in Africa and I reenacted that scene just jokingly and in front of a cheetah. But I just think, and the actors in that movie, from, you know, Frederick Forrest to Harrison Ford, Lawrence Fishburne at 14 years old, you know, to Martin Sheen, to Dennis Hopper, to Marlon Brando. I mean, blah, 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 blah. It's like, whoa, to the Playboy bunnies. It just goes on and on.
Colleen Camp, that's right.
Yeah. Well, maybe it was in Colleen's contract that after a certain number of years, he had to be edited back into the picture.
That's right. Put me back in. Right.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Wow. Well, Fisher, man.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, these are great.
Our first guest of our new incarnation.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks for having me, guys. And this was super fun. And it just opened my mind, as I said, and I can't wait to dig back into my Criterion collection when I finish press today.
Awesome. And tell folks.
When he's doing this in the middle of doing press, imagine how exhausted he is.
This is more fun.
When I'm done doing podcasts.
That's right. when so folks know where can they see Palmer? This is going to drop like right around the time it comes out. So
Palmer will be on Apple TV Plus the 29th of January. And if all goes well this next week, between 25 and 30 theaters across America.
Theaters? Yeah. You mean those places where people all sit together and watch a movie on a big screen?
Yeah, but you're not going to sit together unless you're in the same pod. They're only going to be 25% capacity and no one. Yeah. But listen, I'm grateful they're putting it on the big screen.
No, it's wonderful. It's the way to see a movie.
It used to make me crazy. If I go see a movie in an almost empty theater, it's like 50-50 whether or not some complete stranger will walk into the empty theater, look around, and then sit either right behind you or right next to you. I'm wondering if that's still happening.
Right in front of you.
Anyway, that's not happening. That's not happening. No.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for joining
us. Fisher.
The movie's Great Palmer. It's wonderful.
Great to meet you too.
And if you ever want to come back and talk some more about this stuff, we are here.
We're always here.
All right.
Thank you.
Great to do this, guys. See you later.
Thanks.
Check out Lucia. See you later.
Our show was recorded from several well-stocked bunkers. We can't wait to get back to beautiful downtown Burbank. We're the official podcast of trailersfromhell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for the Movies That Made. Stay safe out there, folks.